Hello, and welcome back to the Beer Truth Podcast, your favorite podcast ever. I'm Tom, and today we get to hear from Lester, one of the three co-founders of Bear Bottle, and Magic, one of the two co-head brewers. Bear Bottle's out of San Francisco. They have a tap room in Santa Clara as well, as we will hear. And at first I was afraid Zoom was going to cut us off at 40 minutes because there's three computers, but the Zoom gods blessed me with a free upgrade or something, so we kept talking. And as a result, this conversation went pretty long, and because of that, I decided to break it into two episodes. So this episode is approximately the first half of the conversation, and next week we'll finish it off with the second half. For Bear Bottle's beers, I know I've had some IPAs somewhere along the way, but I can't remember which ones and don't really do the untapped thing, but either way, they make a ton of beers, so there's always something new to try, but it also means that sometimes you can't remember what you had. So if you're looking for Bear Bottle, you can find pretty much any style you're looking for. I believe they're on Craft Shack and Taver, so you can get them shipped outside of California. Or you can get home delivery. I think they'll mail stuff to you too. But yeah, a lot of styles to choose. A lot of IPAs, hazy, fruit beers. Pretty much everything except for smoked lagers, as Magic mentions. But hey, no one's perfect. We did have a fun conversation though, so let's get to that. I do apologize for a couple places. There's a little bit of echo. Getting three different computers and two that were in the same room working together on Zoom and getting perfect audio was a bit of a challenge, but first time getting three computers on Zoom for one of these interviews, so bear with me on that one. And aside from that, here's Lester and Magic. Well, why don't we start with you guys start with your stories and individually how you guys got to Bear Bottle, and I guess kind of what led you down this path of opening a craft brewery and doing what you're doing, and to where we are, you know, theoretically pre-pandemic, all right, and all that's happened. But
why don't you start, Magic?
Well, I work at Bear Bottle that Lester founded, one of the three founders. But I'm originally from Los Angeles, mechanical engineer by trade, went to school for that and did that for a few years, mostly automation, manufacturing for the food industry. Didn't realize I would be going into food afterwards, which is kind of funny. Did that for a few years and, you know, needed a hobby and found home brewing after falling in love with craft beer. Specifically, Stone was my gateway into all of this, being from SoCal. That was the major gateway. I caught the homebrew bug and decided someday I'd open a brewery just like everybody else, and got an opportunity to actually brew in San Francisco at a brew pub that was opening up. So I moved all my stuff up here, worked at this brew pub for about a year, and never actually got to brew because they never got the brewery installed, which is kind of funny. So I was just a beer buyer and bartender, server, whatever they needed at the time. Was still homebrewing up here. Luckily, I had a spot in San Francisco that I could. And ended up finding Bear Bottle one day, and they were doing homebrew competitions at the time. Still do. And I entered one of them and won. Lo and behold, I found out through one of the bartenders here that they were hiring. I'm like, oh, may as well apply. I'd already got to know Lester. And next thing you know, I'm here washing kegs and little by little now helping manage production here.
Right on. Lester, how about you?
Yeah, so a pretty similar story, except started a few years earlier. So kind of as Magic mentioned, wait, are you guys hearing the echo? I hear the echo now. Thomas, if you're good on sound, then
I'm not hearing it.
All right. Yeah. So like a pretty similar story, you know, the origin of loved home brewing, got into home brewing, Going back a little bit more into the Bear Model history, the other co-founders, Mike Seitz, Ben Sterling, we were all business school friends from back east. We all kind of went our separate ways afterwards into, you know, corporate America, corporate middle America, rather. And, you know, we kind of had talked about, as we were leaving business school, like doing something together. But that was just kind of like an idea at that point. And then I think the moment that it all began to transpire was we were down in Mexico for a friend's wedding. And then Mike had the Joy of Homebrewing book, the Charlie Papazian book. And he was reading it and, you know, Mike's a crazy guy and just like dived in the deep end of everything. And he was like, hey, like, this is really cool. Like, you guys got to start homebrewing. So, you know, we were all beer drinkers, craft beer drinkers, fans. And then, you know, once we started reading and trying our hand at homebrewing, you know, as Magic said, it was just like an addiction. We just kind of all got into it and we realized, you know, how great and how fresh homebrew beer can be. And then just kind of slid further and further down the rabbit hole. And we became BJCP judges, started judging homebrew competitions. And, you know, as we were judging these homebrew competitions, it dawned on us like, oh man, like the beers that are winning the categories, that are winning best of show in these competitions are probably better than 90% of commercial beers available. And so we thought like, wow, there's just like, there's so much like pent up like talent and demand on the homebrewing side. You know, we should try to find a way to like marry that into big production brewing. And so we started business planning. Again, you know, life gets in the way. We're doing fine in our companies. And then, you know, finally it became a moment of, after call it 5 years of business planning and just getting on weekly conference calls and going through the business plan ad nauseum, we're just like, you know, if we don't do it now, like life's going to get even busier. And, you know, we just got to take that leap now and do the American dream and go for broke and get it started. So that's kind of what we did. We did kind of a family and friends round of fundraising. So it's all friendly money. Got what we needed and then got started here in Bernal Heights, neighborhood of San Francisco.
Okay. So you guys have the San Francisco location. You also have the Santa Clara. Yep. Why, at what point did you guys decide that, you need that second location, and why Santa Clara specifically? Was that like a real estate, you know, it's the right fit, or far enough that you're not poaching your own customers from San Francisco?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit of all that, Tom. I mean, on the one hand, we were pretty unique in the sense that, like, when we got started, we started on a, and we're still on a 20 barrel system. So like, again, like for people who've never come from the kind of professional brewing background, a little bit bigger than what you would initially kind of envision. Secondly, the building itself is about 16,000 square feet here in San Francisco. So again, a little bit bigger of a building than you would have expected kind of a startup brewery to be in. But one thing that became pretty apparent to us is, as we were planning it out, is that, you know, so often as we were like talking to people who started breweries, talking to our friends and people and friends of friends, that we noticed that most people, if they're successful, grow out of their small system, you know, it's a 7-barrel system or a 5-barrel system or whatever, very, very quickly. And then it becomes a, you know, there's not only just the headache of opening up a brewery to begin with, but imagine the headache of, you just did it and you're successful in year two and you got to do it all over again and find a bigger spot. And now you've got customers and employees and you got to find a new location or a bigger brew house. And so we said, you know, if we're going to do this, like, let's do this right. Let's plan for success or plan for broke. And so that's why we got a bigger building for room for expansion. So we kind of planned for success in the very beginning and said, okay, like, let's grow into this space. If we're successful, then we don't have to do this all over again. And now we're approaching, you know, year 4.5, almost year 5 now. And we haven't quite outgrown this spot yet, though we're getting close, as Magic can probably attest to, you know, as we talk about growing pains. So that was good for San Francisco, you know. But the other thing that we realized, and I think a lot of people, you know, eventually find this out in the craft beer world is so much revenue, like a disproportionate amount of revenue, comes from the taproom model. You know, comes from being able to make a beer and just slide it across the bar and sell it directly to a customer. Because you're not having to deal with cans or labels or a canner or a distributor. In our case, we're self-distributed, but even then, like, there's all these layers of costs on something that you then have to sell wholesale when you go anywhere else but your own building. So if it's your own building, your own bar, you kind of capture all that margin. And so we saw a couple things. One, like, that's predominantly like what was really paying the bills was the tap room. And we're really fortunate being here in San Francisco, and especially being here in Bernal Heights, where we're in the middle of a neighborhood. So it's not like we're in an industrial park of San Francisco. You know, Mike kind of led the real estate charge when we were looking for spaces, and, you know, painstakingly like found a building that was in the middle of an actual neighborhood. So there's literally like, you know, apartments, condos across the street from us, which is pretty unusual for San Francisco. And having like lived here for a bunch of years, you know, I realized that, you know, the energy and kind of the magic of San Francisco happens in the neighborhoods, doesn't really happen in downtown, because people may work downtown, but they all live in the neighborhoods. And I think that's what's great about San Francisco is you have this neighborhoody feel, as anybody who lives here can attest to. So, you know, you have this idea of, okay, more revenue, a disproportionate amount of revenue comes from the taproom model. And California being the state that it is allows you to have duplicate licenses. And so we said, okay, like, we'd love to open up another tap room, kind of get out to another segment of the Bay Area that we resonate well with. And that's where it was helpful to kind of be as diversified as we are in selling beer. So, you know, we always had the tap room here in San Francisco, but we have our own sales team. We have our own delivery drivers. We have our own delivery vehicles. And so we really quickly, and do, I think, to the quality of the beer as well, as, you know, grow Bear Bottle, you know, in a sizable way very quickly. And once we signed up an account like Whole Foods, for example, we started getting a lot of really good data in terms of, we can see exactly, you know, where a disproportionate amount of off-premise sales are happening. And, you know, being able to see that in the South Bay, we were probably selling like as much beer in retail down there as we were in San Francisco. And that's where it dawned on us, like, okay, like, the South Bay always kind of lives a little bit in the shadow of San Francisco, but is a bigger population, you know, has a lot of income down there as well. And so we looked at the data and said, where are we selling a lot of beer? And it was in the South Bay. And we felt that it was kind of disproportionately served as far as, you know, craft breweries down there as well. So again, just kind of rolled the dice. And we opened about 3 weeks before COVID hit, which is right in the middle of Beer Week last year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for the 3 weeks that was opened, it, you know, it outperformed San Francisco like 6 out of the 7 days a week. And, you know, anybody who's ever been here on a Friday, a Saturday, or a Sunday, like, this place rocks in terms of the number of people and the energy here. And that was kind of a great proof of concept. And then COVID hit, and then the world changed. And then, you know, here we are on Zoom.
Yeah. Are you guys brewing in Santa Clara, or is it just in San Francisco and then send stuff down to Santa Clara?
Yeah, Santa Clara is strictly just a tap room. So all production happens up here.
Okay. Well, on the beer side, on the website, you guys have you list your recipes for 5 gallon batches, and I didn't know that you guys were so far into homebrewing beforehand. So that really makes a lot of sense. Because that's a, you know, like craft beer in general, that's a very open and I guess communal community. It's probably a better way to say that, but
no, communal community is pretty good.
But yeah, very collaborative, and I think it's I don't think you could get more collaborative than giving people your recipes. On, and, you know, it's a different scale, but, you know, it's obviously, you're not going to take a 5 gallon batch and just scale it straight to 20 barrels. on a different system.
You'd be surprised. Yeah.
Is that what you guys have done?
Absolutely. I mean, from the homebrew competitions, we scale anytime we have a winner, we have to take those recipes that they brewed at home and scale them up, including my own. Is it a one-to-one science? Actually, pretty close.
Okay.
The hops tend to be the biggest difference that changes between a small scale and large scale is time. The time that it takes for things to happen, from, you know, whirlpooling to knocking out to, you know, just how long it takes for that ingredients are in contact with your wort. And so just adjusting for that. And we've gotten pretty good at, we know our system well enough now that we can adjust for that, especially if we get to taste the beer as well. It just means moving hops later into the process. Maybe there are some things that we can't do just at scale will clog our equipment. So maybe we'll figure out ways to do it. But for the most part, it actually is it's not too dissimilar from homebrewing, just much, much bigger.
Okay.
And the key is Beersmith software. So if you're a home brewer, you know what that is, and go buy it and, you know, pay the men their money, because it's really cheap, like $30 a year or something ridiculous. But we use that software to scale up and conversely to scale down. So like when we do a recipe here first, like we'll scale it down using Beersmith, because it's a great software, and it's like basically free at $30.
Yeah, I know they do. I think they might have two different podcasts, but very, very interesting in that homebrew world, where that really I think found its place to start with, and very good reputation for Beersmith.
Putting the recipes were important for us as well, is because, again, like, we're homebrewers at heart. And, you know, as we homebrew, like, we're always like, oh, man, how do I make Pliny the Elder? And, you know, we follow the lead of people like Vinny at Russian River and just, like, share the recipes. So we were sharing the recipe with people who would call us or email us and say, hey, Galaxy Dust, we love that beer. How do we make it? And we would just send them the brew sheet and be like, here, you know, knock yourself out. And, like, we knew, like, that's something that we really wanted for just transparency, but also, like, this virtuous circle of we hold homebrew competitions. We do, like, these little pro-am competitions with folks. And so, like, we are hoping that the more people that get into homebrewing will then become better homebrewers and submit recipes to us and ideas for us and join competitions with us. And then we get a lot of really kind of great ideas, like I haven't told Magic this yet, but like, I mean, even I think about, let's see, it's 4:20. It's like about 3 hours ago, somebody called in the tap room and said, hey, I've got some questions about MC Aromatics. Like, how do I brew this? Can I speak to somebody who may know? And like, you just speak to me. Like, what do you need to know? And he was asking about when terminal gravity is, or how you know when it's terminal gravity. And, you know, like, we love fielding these questions, and we've gotten them for the last 4 years. So, you know, it's just like endlessly inspirational for us when people will drink a can of our beer or a bottle of our beer and like it so much that they will follow the recipe on the side and brew it. And, you know, we're happy to help them on the journey to kind of get there.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, overall, you know, you hear a lot of the stories of, you know, collaboration and you know, sharing ingredients or loaning someone ingredients down the street because they, you know, couldn't get whatever hop contract. And it's always a good way to come back to why this is a great community to start with. A lot of the pictures on the website of the beers, like just looking through what's on tap and everything like that. You guys have a lot of fruit, a lot of other adjuncts like cinnamon and coffee and all kinds of stuff like that. Do you guys use a lot of fruit in beers, or is that something that's more like a visual representation of what you're going to taste?
You have no idea.
We both. I think the pictures, for the most part, especially on our regular hazy IPAs or IPAs in general, fruit speaks volumes as to, hey, we tend to focus on fruit forward beers. People like that. We like that. Everyone loves Mosaic and Citra because it isn't pine trees. It's, you know, passion fruit, guava, mangoes, diesel mangoes. I like, to me, good citrus is diesel mangoes. And so, yeah, I think there's something appetizing about looking at those pictures and going, wow, okay. That being said, we choose a ton of fruit. And it's kind of insane to go back to homebrewing. You realize, oh, I got to add 5 pounds of fruit into my 5-gallon batch. Scale that up to a 1,600-gallon batch. And you're like, oh, that is almost 2,000 pounds of fruit that I've got to figure out how to put into this beer. Just to even stay to that level. And we've gone far above and beyond that as well. Because it takes a lot of fruit to really come across in a beer sometimes. And I mean, a lot of what we do is, my job would be a lot easier if we weren't adding any fruit. But we spend a ton of time adding fruit, adding zest, adding adjuncts, coffee, cinnamon, coconut. We've tried all sorts of coconut, toasted coconut, shredded coconut, macaroon coconut, coconut flakes, coconut cream, coconut milk. You're like, which is, when do you use it? Like hot or cold, and cocoa nibs and everything. And that's half the fun. Like, we're still homebrewers at heart and trying to figure out the best way to do it. And what may work at home may not work here just because of that scale. But it's so much fun to add all these ingredients and to coerce those same flavors out of hops. And I think one of our cool finds was Strata. And I know you did a podcast with Jim over at Indie. Mm-hmm. That is, we got onto that early, and it has become our, I think, our second highest contracted hop this year. And it's like the best orange note you've ever had in your entire life. And it comes across and boosts every other hop that's out there when you combine it with stuff. And it, like, being able to have something like that in your toolbox to help bring out that fruit character is incredible. At the same time, we just made an IPA and zested 300 pounds of grapefruit and add that on top of some other hops. And so I guess now we're using actual fruit to boost the flavor of the hops. So there's many ways to get there, and we're not done experimenting. We'll continue to experiment. We don't have any core beers that we have to abide to. And even on our beers that we do repeat, we're always shooting for harder, better, faster, stronger. I just found out Daft Punk broke up, so that happened like 2 days ago. and it's a lot of fun, and we'll have this job. It's great to be in a place where homebrewing is, and well, the idea of homebrewing, that ethos is here, because we're always experimenting. Like, we're not set in any way, shape, or form. We have 7 people in production overall, and every single one of them has been able to write a recipe. It's not just the 2 co-head brewers writing recipes. There's everyone here gets to do something. If they have an idea, like, we'll figure out a way to do it. As long as it's not a smoked lager. That's the only thing we've said no to. But yeah, for the most part, it's a lot of fun to be able to try to do whatever we can and make really cool flavors out of all the hops and ingredients available to us.
No, I mean, the one thing, like, kind of a funny story, like Strata story, is I remember, like, we were up in Yakima on a hop farm. And, you know, we were fortunate to kind of hang out with the owner of the farm and several generation hop grower, and just walk in the fields and sniffing things. And he was like, hey, have you guys tried Strata yet? And this was, you know, maybe 3 years ago. And I'm like, no, I've never even heard of Strata. Like, what is that? He's like, well, this is the best American hop since Citra. And I'm like, oh, wow. Like, you know, color us intrigued. Like, tell us more. And he's like, oh, yeah, like, here are the flavors. And it sounded so good. I'm like, oh, awesome. Like, can I buy some from you? And he's like, no, I don't grow it. And like, to us, like, that's a, like, that is a, if that isn't a, you know, a note of this is how great it is like, people, you know, growers are talking about it, and they don't even grow it themselves. Like, oh no, talk to guys at Indie Hops. Like, they'll help you out. To us, like, that was like, oh, a big flag. Like, this must be good if, you know, hop growers are talking about it and they don't even grow it, have access to it. And then we met Jim and the Indie folks, and it literally, you know, blew us away.
Yeah. And going back to what Magic said about the experimentation and the ability to do that, and it's got to help being self-distributed and not having the distributor to, you know, be asking you every week or every 2 weeks or whatever for X pallets of, you know, flagship West Coast IPA, which I'm perfectly down with, but that's, you know, not having to, I guess calling your own shots has got to be provide that freedom in the brew house to be like, okay, well, we have, you know, we got some passion fruit and it's, you know, it's ripe and it's awesome and we can do X, Y, and Z with it and use it in different beers, different styles, whatever, and just have that ability to just, I guess, really do whatever the hell you want and not have to answer to anyone other than yourselves at the end of the day. And, you know, I'm sure there's always a customer who's not happy with whatever you did, but that's just part of it.
Yeah, 100%. It's, you know, one of the great things, and you mentioned it before about how, like, being in this industry, like, it's great because breweries are so collaborative. They'll share with each other. If we're short on yeasts, you know, or we need a new yeast pitch that we don't want to spend $1,000 for, somebody will be there harvesting it and will sometimes even drive it out to you that day. Like that, that's great. And that's one of the unique things about this industry that I think very few industries have. You know, but like all that being said, it's like, you know, we also, sorry, now I'm like losing my train of thought here as I'm talking about like how great the industry is. Self-distributed. Yeah. So, you know, one of the key things that we like knew like really early on too was freshness matters. You know, being able to get your beer to the customer as quickly and as freshly as possible and, you know, cold stored its entire life. Like those are also critical to a good customer experience, you know, with craft beer. And so the idea of going through a distributor and, you know, they're on the FIFO mess, you know, the first in, first out. So if they got some West Coast IPA 6 months ago and they haven't sold through it yet, well, if an account wants an IPA, they're going to get that 6 month old West Coast IPA in a keg first or a can before you can give them the fresh stuff. So, it just feels like you're behind the eight ball versus, you know, what's great when we're not in COVID times, like we'll empty out a 40 barrel fermenter, whether it's in cans or kegs. And if it's especially a hazy IPA, like all 40 barrels of that IPA is typically sold out within a few hours. And 80% of that volume gets delivered the next day or 2 days afterwards. So, you know, accounts, bars, restaurants, you know, they have an IPA that's like 2 or 3 days old and like at its peak freshness. And you can't beat that. And that's where like it was important for us to kind of go that self-distributed route, because you know that when that beer gets delivered, like how it was handled, because you're the only one who's handled it. And so you have no one else to blame but yourself if something goes wrong. So that's like ultra, ultra critical in terms of kind of craft beer and freshness. But the other thing is, like, as you mentioned before, not, you know, being beholden to a flagship beer. So we, again, like found this out pretty early on, like the modern day craft beer drinker, they're grazers, they're experientialists. They want the new, they want the different. And that's kind of what people have become in terms of craft beer. Before, you know, it's like, I'm a Stella guy or gal, I'm a Sierra Nevada pale guy or gal, but now it's like, no, I'm a bear bottle person. I'm an Alvarado Street person. I'm a fieldwork person, and I'll like anything they, you know, that they put out because they trust that brand. And I feel like, you know, using that model, like everybody wins. Like the experientialists who want to try the new, you keep giving them the new. It kind of, you know, keeps our wheels turning all the time because we're also trying to figure out the new techniques and recipes and ingredients. And so we get to like endlessly experiment versus make the same beer over and over again. And hopefully kind of that enthusiasm around the product then gets translated to the end consumer who gets to drink it at a bar or restaurant.
Yeah. Yeah, I've definitely
Say,
go ahead, Magic.
Real quick, that it's also a blessing and a curse. From a idea creative side, coming up with something new every week, four new things 5 new beers every single week is awesome. Or tweaking something we made 6 or 7 months ago. From an actual production standpoint, keep the logistics behind getting all of those down to ferment in similar schedules to all the brewers have different ideas. I want to dry hop earlier. I want to dry hop late, or I don't want to dry hop, or I want to put twice as much dry hop, or all this crazy ideas. We try to accommodate everything because we don't know where the next great beer is going to come from. Trying to make that work logistically without having flagships per se is a nightmare. I spend so much time in a Google Calendar, but it's at the end of the day, it's all worth it.
Totally. I mean, like, you know, just interrupt, like, you know, we got Magic, we got Kelsey, the other co-head brewer, like, you know, we've got two very smart engineers, you know, running things, because without that, like, you couldn't have the ingredients, like, without that, like, you know, that foresight into recipes, into timing, into planning, like, you couldn't have every recipe that you need for Plug in X beer 3 weeks from now, 4 weeks from now, 6 weeks from now. Like, if, you know, if we show up on a brew day and we're trying to brew a beer and we're like, crap, like, who ordered that hop? Like, where is it? Like, where is it in the building? Oh, crap, nobody ordered it. Like, then all that idea and that planning and the, like, and the romanticism of getting, like, something super right and awesome, this, I guess, like, shot in the foot because we forgot to put an order in with BSG or something. So, to Magic's point, like, it is, like, endless planning, and just, like, you need a lot of smart people to get that right, and luckily we have that.
Yeah, it's just it's fun. It's a fun. I wouldn't change anything about it. It is a lot of fun, and it's like a giant Jenga puzzle to figure out, or Tetris puzzle to make sure all the stars align and have everything come out on time, and then at the same time service our customers, who are not only our taproom customers but our taproom counts, bar counts. They expect a hazy IPA every week, but you know what? They also want to try out that milkshake IPA every once in a while, or a pale ale, or a West Coast IPA, or a double IPA, or double West Coast IPA, or fruited sour. Oh, we already had passion fruit last week. We need a different fruit. Like, we try to keep the whole thing varied, and it's very open to what we do, and there's a lot of room for maneuvering, but it's still, in a weird way, like, rigid in that we plan things so far out in advance, just ideas to make sure that we can have all the creative freedom that we do.
Yeah, I know seeing a beer from a brewery that I know was self-distributed and you know, getting their main flagship West Coast IPA, and it's like showing up at the bottle shop or the bar and be like, this was canned or kegged yesterday or 2 days ago and delivered by them, and then, you know, it's like, I mean, other than basically drinking it off the bright tank, you're not going to get much fresher as a consumer. And then going to when they signed on with a distributor, it's like, all right, well, it's 3 weeks old. I mean, I guess I'll take 3 week old beer, but, you know, sarcastically, because that's still pretty with a distributor.
I will say,
I feel like,
yes,
you have,
I think,
thoughts
beer
here.
Off the bright tank. Beer off the bright tank is the best beer we'll ever taste. I've been spoiled, and it's really hard to go back. Secondly, though, I actually do think, especially the hazy IPAs, those beers in particular, when you can them, when you package them, it's almost as if they go through like bottle shock or can shock, the way like wine does. There's something about moving them. And the fact that, you know, we don't filter them. There's probably a little yeast still in suspension, no matter how long we leave them cold, and they just settle better in a smaller container. To me, the hazy IPAs almost peak. They're already good day one, but they almost get better and better and better. And about a week in, maybe 2 weeks or something for a double IPA, they are even better. It's like everything's melded. Everything has hit an equilibrium of just, you know, there's the right amount of everything going on in the beer, and they're, in my opinion, almost better. Green
heard
beer
people say that about, especially the stuff, you know, hazy stuff or stuff that's maybe got stuff in suspension, that some people will even you know, buy it and then throw it in the fridge and wait a week or two or three and seem to like that a little better than right the next day.
It's a weird struggle because I'm with you. I like it. I would rather not have stuff in the beer, but it's taken me a long time to like come to the realization there, that whole, the bite and the yeast, and they do something that is, that people seem to enjoy. And they, in a weird way, add to the experience that or a lot of people expect that experience when drinking these hazy IPAs. And it's, you know, drinking these from day one and day five and day 10 and 20, it's a different experience every time, which is kind of fun. We used to, you know, biofine, make sure we got every little piece of everything out of these beers. We still do to an extent, but the beers are really good, but they would almost get worse right away as opposed to like peaking a few weeks later. And so there's, it's learning the beers, learning what, you know, every beer is different as well. Certain hops are different. Certain hops like to linger, certain other hops don't. Every ingredient is different for some reason as well. And the way they're processed, different pelletizers and different companies we get a same hop from can be different. So there's a lot to always deal with and figure out. But fresh beer is really good. Hazy IPA, maybe wait a week.
Yeah, I've like you're saying, just all the different things that really go into it and impact from that conversation I have with Jim. Just even learning about, which hops like an early harvest or a little bit later harvest, and just so many different factors that go into every ingredient, that the way that things turn out are, there's a lot of factors that go into that final beer and every ingredient in it, whether there's fruit or whether there's other stuff, or it's just, you know, water, malt, hops, and yeast. Mm-hmm. There's so much that goes into it. It's kind of mind blowing to think about every scientific aspect that can be manipulated. And it's really made me realize there's a reason that I dropped out of organic chemistry and don't do this for a living.
I mean, there's so much planning we can do as well as brewers. And I still read and listen to podcasts and try to learn as much about ingredients. And you're like, all right, I understand Mosaic now. And then you go use somebody else's Mosaic. I'm like, that was totally different. And like, well, there's only so much I think you can read and try to apply, but then there's what actually happens in the brew house. And I think that's half the fun, is the not knowing and hoping for the best sometimes. And building on your experiences. And I'm sure if you go to any brewery that's opened up day one and go revisit them 2 years later, they've learned from those, for those 2 years, about all their ingredients and everything they're doing, and their beer is only better because of that. And it's a wild thing where that experience matters a lot. And trying things, our process has completely changed and the last 3.5 years that I've been here, it's completely different because we've learned what makes a better beer, where dry hopping techniques are continuously changing and trying to maximize what we get out of every single hop we use. And our yeast are changing, everything's changing, water, everything changes all the time in an effort to just create a better product.
Right. All right, I thought that was a pretty good place to stop for this week. It's about halfway, and before we change topics. So, again, next week we will wrap up this conversation, and it is a fun one. I really enjoyed it. So, thanks to Lester and Magic for joining me and making it happen. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you get all the latest episodes downloaded automatically. Follow the show on Instagram and Facebook, and that's really all there is to it. Please give the show a rating wherever you can. And the best thing to help spread the word would be tell your friend about the show. Word of mouth is great because it's basically a recommendation built in from somebody you trust. So that always helps a lot. And as we close out the episode, I would like to say that after the last year in America, there's been a lot of hatred and division sewn around. And once again, we saw that carried out to an extreme in Georgia a couple days ago. 8 Asian Americans murdered because some white asshole with a gun just did as he pleased. I don't know how long we can do this. We gotta be better than this. It starts with difficult conversations and working to make change on an institutional basis. It's just wrong. And we can't keep doing this, just tearing each other apart with hatred and violence. So I did want to mention that. We have to be better than this. And yeah. So to not end this on a sad, terrible note, just remember next week we finish this conversation with Beer Bottle. And then the next week after that will be something a little beyond beer. Don't worry, it's not kombucha, because that's not going to happen. But till the next round, which I guess it's actually the end of this round, Sláinte, and happy belated St. Patrick's Day.
It's a nice apocalypse poster you got back there.